The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretics Hour on Monday, August 13th. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. I want to start out tonight by mentioning donations. Tan Stoffel and I want to thank those who have sent money to the network, the White Network. It's very encouraging because that's when you know people really appreciate what you're doing. Not that I think everyone has to do it. You don't. But we want to acknowledge those who have beyond the email I send to them. I also get personal donations, and I'm grateful to those good friends who are so generous, some of whom are sending something every month. I got one today from a regular contributor, Paul. Thanks, Paul. It's nice to be able to thank someone individually on the air. And I have quite a few listeners already, so I'm glad that you're all here. You really make me feel good about doing the show, and you must be somewhat interested in the topic tonight, so that's good. In case I forget at the end of the first hour, I want to tell you to expect some different break music tonight. That's a big deal here, changing the music. It is Sleipnir's. I always thought it was Sleipnir, but now I see the spelling. I think it's Sleipnir, but if I'm mispronouncing it, I'm really sorry. His the song Opa, ich vermisse dich, or Grandfather, I Miss You, in English. It's in remembrance of the hundreds of thousands of young German family men who fell in the war and are not honored in the country they fought for. Very nice song, and I'm glad I was able to get it onto the Heretics Hour now. Now, introductory to tonight's show, let me say that the recent discussion that's been going on, at least in my circles, and circles, I guess, who you are familiar with, too, you who are listening and will be listening, on Holocaust, I'm not going to call it Holocaust anymore. I'm calling it Holocaust revisionism as it relates to white nationalism, I think is very beneficial. This has not been talked about in this way before, I don't think, not much, where you tie the two things together. But we do have to thank Greg Johnson for writing that article that has gotten so much attention and really gotten him into a lot of hot water, but he tries to deny that, and has led to so many other, has led to other articles, one of which is Thomas Dalton's article, in which I think is titled Nationalism and the Holocaust. But I published it on my website and on the White Network, both. And then I found out that he really is the author of it, because I was a little bit in doubt for a while because I didn't see it anywhere. Well, it turns out that nobody will publish it, not the revisionists. I don't know if they will ever publish it. Or the mainstream nationalists, like the Occidental Observer, Countercurrents, Council of Conservative Citizens, maybe even Occidental Dissent, or even Chechar, who's a little flaky, but he's, I have to say that. I don't think they don't like what he says in there. And he's very persuasive, Thomas Dalton, who is a revisionist. And I like very much what he says, so I'm going to promote that particular essay. And we want to keep this discussion going. I was going to talk tonight about building white nationalism, white consciousness, I mean, building white consciousness, kind of around along in that. And also, when that kind of fell through, then talk about the National Alliance, but that didn't quite come through either. This is a not of the best time of year in August for people to be free, and I have been contacting people at the last minute, I admit, because I go from one show to the next, and I'm not planning ahead too well. And so things. But that then, when those were kind of, didn't quite work out, I thought, well, I will do these. I will talk about these other things, which I really wanted to talk about, and now I have my chance. So we'll get to these other things in future shows. I want to maybe next week talk about the National Alliance under William Pierce, but also and how what he would be saying about building white consciousness at this time, and what needs to be done for that, and how active should we do? Should we be involved just in information and educating people, or is it the wrong time to act on in the real world? I still like the idea of an ADL for white people. I was going to follow through on that tonight too, but you know, the right people were not available. So that's that. We'll get back to that. So tonight, I'm going to talk about some threads on two forums. Kind of a strange topic, maybe for my show. But then what's on there interests me very much, and I have a lot of comments. Now, you know, I'm not a member of either of these forums, and I don't post on them. So I haven't posted anything myself, but I think it's okay if I comment on them as a reader of them, an observer. So then if there's time, I've got some things on the third topic of building white consciousness, but I don't know that there's going to be time for that. We'll see. Now, anyway, I'm going to start with the CODO forum thread on Hitler escaping from the bunker, and that thread title is exactly Hitler's Escape and the Implications for the Big Holo, if you have any interest in going there to look at it, which I think if you have interest in this topic, you should. I'm going to be going over that. But I'm going to start, I'm going to wait on that a little bit. I'm going to start with talking about Harry Cooper. Now, excuse me. The whole idea about Adolf Hitler escaping alive from the bunker in Berlin and going off to Argentina, and some people actually have him going to Antarctica, and other nonsense like that is so ludicrous to me and so unbelievable, and yet so many people like to indulge in it, and people are ready to believe it, which is what I found out on this CODO thread, which is what surprised me so much. I was kind of amazed, and so that's why I wanted to talk about it. Anyway, the person I want to start with is Harry Cooper, who's been running what he calls Shark Hunters International Incorporated for 29 years, he claims, on his website. And in my opinion, he's a real showman and a salesman, but that's okay. It's not against the law. He labels his website the official publication of the history of the U-Boot Waffe, with a fancy Germanic-looking logo. Official publication. And then he headlines, based on that, I think, or what that's based on is, quote, "The veterans of the U-Boot Waffe consider Shark Hunters to be the official publication of U-Boat history." Now, that's interesting, isn't it? The veterans of U-Boot Waffe, I'm not even sure what that is, but if that's just all the submarine commanders, you know, German submarine commanders or something, that's what that was called. So if you're a veteran of that, you're part of that. Not something official, maybe, but more unofficial. Anyway, he says they consider these men consider Shark Hunters to be the official publication of U-boat history. So that's what makes it the official publication, obviously. So right away, he's starting with a little sleight of hand there. And he seems to be using this one German submarine skipper, Hans-Georg Hess, who was nice enough to cooperate with him to convince us that all these Germans are friends of his and members of his board. Now, he says about a lot of them, you know, he's got pictures of them, and maybe he got the pictures somewhere, or maybe he wrote to them, and they were nice enough to send him a picture. I cannot deny that maybe they are really interested in this, what he's doing, because it's all about subs, and they're, of course, have to be very interested in subs, submarines, so you know, they would go along with it to some degree. But here's what he says about one of them, not Hans Georg Hess, but another one. He says, winner of the Knight's Cross, Oak Leaf, and Cross Swords, Flotillan Admiral Otto Kretschmer, which would be Flotillan, was a member from 1985 until his death in 1998. A member of this Shark Hunters. What? The Shark Hunters official, I don't know what it is, official organization. And Otto Kretschmer wrote to him, many thanks for my membership. Well, right there. You know, he sent him a free membership. And the membership includes the magazine. It has a name, but KT something. It includes the Shark Hunters Submarine magazine. So naturally, you know, why wouldn't he like it? He was nice. And of course, Germans are very polite, particularly to Americans. And so he writes, you know, thanks him for the free membership. Free membership. He says, be sure that my best wishes for your health and happiness are on their way across the Atlantic with the velocity of light. Okay. So, I'm sure all these other Germans, and there are about half of them are from the U.S. Navy, United States military, and the other half are German. I'm sure they were all sent free memberships. And many of them thanked him, and he may have asked for a picture of them, a signed picture. When he gets a signed picture, he has a bunch of signed photographs of these various men, and he sells them. But he may send a portion of what he makes on them to them. I don't know. But anyway, he sells them. Signed photographs of these men. And he shows all the pictures. Now, I'm just trying to say that he gets a lot of readers and followers, and he sells books, he sells DVDs, he sells coffee mugs. He sells autographed photos, as I already said, and he holds seminars, which aren't cheap. And he has a big mailing list then from the people who join become members of Shark Hunters. And he can, you know, sell to these people and reach more people. Now, one thing I can tell you is that, somewhere between a year and 2 years ago, I was contacted by someone who had already contacted me and told me how much they liked my Heretics Hour program. And then he started suggesting that I have Harry Cooper as a guest. And I looked at Harry Cooper's website and I, you know, didn't care for it too much, and I didn't think that it was what I wanted to do. So I didn't, I'm not sure, I may not have even answered him. I may have answered this person, but then I started getting emails from Harry Cooper in saying, you should have me on your program. And I didn't answer those emails because I thought, you know, I didn't write to him. And if he wants to write to me and ask to be on the program, I don't have to answer him. That may have been the wrong thing to do. Maybe it's my the only decent thing for me to answer and say no thank you. But I knew that... by then, that if I had responded, he would have just kept emailing me, would have just kept writing to me and bugging me, because that's the way he is. And he did anyway keep writing and bugging me. And then he started telling me what a rotten person I was for not replying to him, not having the decency to reply to him, and so on. So that's and he's been saying that around the internet ever since. Every time anybody brings up my name to him, he lets them know. Sometimes he's CC'd those emails to me. He lets them know what a terrible, rude person I am. Anyway, that didn't endear me any, but I really, it didn't make any difference because I'm not interested in what he's doing. The thing is that why I'm talking about him for so long is that, he has written one of these books, Escape from the Bunker. And this came out in 2010, 2 years ago. And he billed it as absolute proof of Adolf Hitler's escape from Europe in summer 1945. Well, it's no such thing. I mean, that's absolutely untrue, absolute proof. But, you know, this guy, is a little bit, he's a real showman. He doesn't care if what he does looks to be exaggerated and so on. It doesn't bother him, obviously, because he keeps doing it. Well, he had us this seminar on his book, even though the book was 2 years ago, just a few months ago. And he had been advertising this seminar for quite a while, and I got some of the emails about it. But I have deleted all those, so I can't say what they were or if I learned from that how much it cost to go to this seminar. And I was, I tried to find it on the internet today, but it's like been erased. There's not a word anywhere about, you know, left over anywhere about this seminar, you know, advertising this seminar. But he said that he had more people than ever. He had to have two of them. It was either two of them in one day or on two different days because he had so many people wanted to come. And that's possibly true because this is one of those things. This is one of those subjects that attract people immensely. Oh, stories about proof that Adolf Hitler, escaped, from the bunker and, how he did it, where he went, how long he lived, what he was doing there, and all this stuff. And I know that people fall for this because it's like some of it can be kind of like science fiction. You know, you just enjoy reading about it because whoever is writing it, and there's more books about this than Harry Cooper's. And I was looking at some of them. I would really like to read some of the reviews of them, but I don't have time to do that. So, but it's, you know, they're not good books. I mean, anybody who's a sharp thinker and reads these books, they say, this book is nothing, you know, the proof is just not there and it's not well thought out and it's not careful and so on. But there's a whole bunch of other people who write and say, oh, this was just fantastic. Oh, I learned so much. Oh, I just, you know, everybody should read it. So this is where you cater to people's ignorance and people's lowest inclinations to just read a bunch of stuff, that's exciting and different and you think you're getting the inside dope or something and, you're just wasting your time. And you're spending money too. Now, these people write these books because they make money, because they sell. And, even if they're no good, they still sell for a while. And they make enough money to make it worthwhile at least. So, let's see. Okay. Now, this Harry Cooper's book, Escape from the Bunker, is, here's what he says about it. Okay. This is what he says. On his big ad about it on the internet. As you read through this book, taken from the file of a Spanish spy who worked for the Reich, okay, a Spanish spy worked for the Reich and who saw Hitler and Eva Braun forcibly drugged and removed from the Führer bunker under orders of Martin Bormann. Can you believe that? Would anybody believe that? That Hitler and Eva were forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann. And you will realize, he says, that Hitler's suicide was a well-conceived escape plan by the man who desperately had to keep the Reich and thereby Hitler alive, Martin Bormann. Well, Martin Bormann is made out to be such a powerful man. He certainly was powerful amongst other National Socialists and party people. Because he was the one who controlled access to Hitler. But that doesn't mean that he had any control over Hitler, nor did he try to exercise it because he knew he wouldn't get anywhere with it. So now Cooper goes on to say, this book also contains photos of places Hitler lived in Argentina. Just think, they take pictures of some buildings or homes or something and say, this is one of the places where Hitler stayed. You know, it's only photos of the places. It's not photos of him there. And then interviews with people there and in Europe. You know, so they interview some people who say, oh, yeah, he was here. And then they says they have FBI and OSS files clearly stating that they, that is the FBI and the OSS, and the United States government, knew that Hitler did not die in Berlin. Well, they don't know that. The only thing that this is all based on is the fact that there is no good evidence of Hitler and Eva's bodies, but I don't know that there's any evidence of the Goebbels' bodies either. I don't know. You know, you don't hear about that. It doesn't mean, okay, so there's no forensic evidence, at least that they let anybody know of, but there's no evidence of this escape either. So they seem to kind of forget that. So now here's another thing that is on Harry Cooper's own advertising for his book that tells us about it. He says, this book is the faithful transcription of a file given to me, this is Harry speaking, by a highly placed Nazi agent during World War II. So some guy came to him and said, I was a highly placed Nazi agent, and here is a transcription of what I saw and did in this file. It's not a government file. It's just this guy's file. And Harry says, he came to Shark Hunters, our history organization, covering World War II submarine history, with his story that he helped Martin Bormann escape Germany after the war. Okay, if somebody came to you with a story that he helped Martin Bormann escape Germany after the war, what would you do? Well, I guess if you thought you could make something out of it, you would talk to him, and that's what Harry did. And Harry says that this unknown guy, said that he met with Adolf Hitler years later. Okay, and he said he has been thoroughly checked out by Harry. Harry checked him out, and he was who he said he was. What, a Spanish spy for the Nazis during World War II. And his claims have been substantiated by countless files from the U.S. and other nations' intel agencies. Do you believe that? And Harry signs this. Now, you know, anybody who would believe that, I have to tell, and there's people who do want to believe it. They read that and they say, oh, okay, I'll read this book and I'll find out. And then when they read the book, they are easily fooled. A lot of people are, by the way these books are written. They shouldn't be, but they are, because I'm sure if I read that book, I would just see so much wrong with it, it wouldn't be funny. Now, there's a newer book out that I'm just going to mention briefly. It came out in October 2011, so not quite 1 year ago, not even a year ago. And it's called Gray Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. It's by Simon Dunstan and Gerard Williams. These are two British men. And, you know, even though there's already several of these books, they write another one. Why? Because when a new one comes out, there's more people out there who will buy it, and they can sell enough of them. They get a snazzy-looking cover, and they promise some things. This one promises not much, but it says, did Hitler, codenamed Grey Wolf, really die in 1945? Question mark. Gripping new evidence shows what could have happened. Can you imagine? Gripping new evidence, which doesn't amount to much, shows what could have happened, and yet people will bypass that word and maybe think it's even read what would have happened, or they just won't care. Well, if it could have happened, it might have happened, so let's see what could have happened, because we don't know what happened, so this might tell me something. So, you know, one of the things they say in all these books is that Truman asked Stalin in 1945 whether Hitler was dead, and Stalin replied bluntly, no. Well, you know, we don't even know if that's true. Is there a recording of that? How many witnesses to that there was? But this is a story that goes around. And people just read it and they believe it. I mean, it might be true. You know, Stalin said a lot of things. But, and it says that as late as 1952, Eisenhower declared, we have been unable to unearth one bit of tangible evidence of Hitler's death. Well, that might be true. And Eisenhower probably said that, but in what context? I don't know, in answer to a question of some kind or whatever. But anyway, it says that here's what the book by Dunstan and Williams says about itself. It says that these two writers have compiled extensive evidence, some recently declassified, that Hitler actually fled Berlin and took refuge in a remote Nazi enclave in Argentina. The recent discovery that the famous Hitler skull in Moscow is female, as well as newly uncovered documents, provide powerful tools for their case. Okay, there's nothing to that. Then they cite people, places, and dates in over 500 detailed notes. Well, one of the reviews I read on Amazon was that these notes were very poorly done and didn't really amount to anything. So, you know, but they're bragging that there's 500 of them. And they identify the escape routes, the vehicles, aircraft, U-boats, and hideouts, you know, all that stuff they make up. And but this is what's interesting. Among the details they promise you in this book, the CIA's possible involvement. So the CIA was involved in getting Hitler out of Berlin and into Argentina. And Hitler's life in Patagonia, that supposedly is where he ended up, including his two daughters. And this has come in too. This same reviewer said that the inclusion of the two daughters was just kind of thrown in there. I mean, it was just included without any explanation of too much, you know, and not much was said about them. Because they don't know anything about him, because it's all just a fable. So these two daughters, one that these books talk about, one was supposedly Hitler's daughter that he already had, which secretly, I don't know, I don't think she was supposed to be Eva Braun's, I don't think she was supposed to be his with Eva Braun, some daughter he supposedly had. And then Eva Braun was supposedly pregnant, at the end there when they left. And so once they were in Argentina, she gave birth to a daughter of the two. And so they had these two daughters with them. All right. Now I'm going to the Kodo forum. And this thread that showed up there just Saturday morning, it was started by Borgestick. Borgestick has been there for several months. And he's quite a frequent poster. He posts a lot of comments there. And he doesn't really have a whole lot to say, but he's a good-natured guy who, he's British, who, is a, what I would call a British patriot. He's middle-aged from the things he said, and he has come to understand and is interested in the Holocaust as being not true. He's clear about that, but he still thinks that the war had to be fought and the British were the heroes for defeating the Germans because of Hitler, and that all that had to be done, and he hasn't given in on that subject yet. So I've never cared for him much. He started there when I was still on it, and by the way, I'm not on Kodo because I was banned. I've been permanently banned from Kodo twice. I could probably get back on if I tried hard enough, but I don't because I would just end up being banned again. and I don't like the way posts are deleted. I've had so many posts deleted, and there's a lot I could say about that, that whole deleting posts business, but I believe I've talked about that before, and I still think about 7-Up and how he's gone, and he'd been there for a long time, and he was always complaining about the deleting posts, and finally he got really mad at the moderator, and then next thing you know, he was gone, and those posts that he had messages he had written about it were gone, and all that just gets buried. So that's why I don't go on, but here I am. But I read it, and I keep up with it fairly well. But some of it gets really dull. However, this one, I'm shocked at some of the things that some of these people are saying. So Borgestick says he's currently reading the book Grey Wolf, the one I just mentioned, by Gerard Williams. He doesn't mention the other author. And he says his central claim is that Hitler, Eva Braun, and others escaped from Berlin in the last few days by plane for Denmark, thanks to Fuerteventura in the Spanish Canary Islands. Then they boarded a U-boat for Argentina. Once there, they lived in a completely isolated compound staffed entirely by Germans. Bormann joined them, as did Hitler's daughter, and Eva Braun gave birth to a second daughter soon after. Then he says, Bormann and Hitler ran the huge financial funds they held and financed Germany's rebuilding program post-war. Now, I found that really strange, and nobody asked about it. None of the other posters who posted after this commented on that. That this must be from the book, that Gray Wolf that he read. And to say that Bormann, two dead men, but Bormann and Hitler ran a huge financial funds, ran a huge financial fund they held, even while they were hiding out, and they financed Germany's rebuilding program, post-war rebuilding program. That is really incredible, but it's just there and nobody comments on it. Obviously, they know it doesn't make sense, so they didn't comment on it. Borchester goes on and says, it makes some sense as the so-called suicide of Hitler and Braun doesn't hold much water. Well, why doesn't it hold water? You know, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. However, he seems to think that if the suicide of Hitler and Braun is not proven sufficiently, then we can decide that they left the bunker and they took off for Argentina, where they lived happily ever after with their children. He says, however, if Hitler, he says a little more, which I'm not going to read, but he says, however, if Hitler was alive and living comfortably in Argentina until 1962, so this book proposes that Hitler died in Argentina in 1962, which would have been at the age of 69, what would he have been doing? Reading about the destruction? No, I say, what would he have been doing? He says he was living there as the architect. Hitler was living in Argentina comfortably until 1962 as the architect of the Holocaust. Surely the world would want him captured. Well, he doesn't always write too well. He means that Hitler was the architect of the Holocaust. That is, he was responsible for it. So how did he stay there, you know, without being captured? Or was this a massive cover-up? See, this is the way they answer these things. When they can't answer questions, because if Adolf Hitler had escaped and anybody had any inkling that he had, all the allies and all those police agencies they have all over the world would have been hunting, and they would have found him. There's no way. What power did he have? How would he have stayed? So then you have to say, oh, well, then the CIA was protecting him. Oh, well, this is a massive cover-up from, you know, all the allies were in it on it with the Nazis, and oh boy, now we've got a real story. This adds an amazing element, he says. What a dolt. Now, surprisingly, but not so surprisingly, Wolf Hank comes in on this. If you don't know Wolf Hank, he is a revisionist who has written a lot for the Inconvenient History Revisionist blog. And he and I had a little falling out quite a while back when I was on the RBN network for a while. And when he looked into the Eichmann case and was using the work of this social democrat journalist, Weber, Gabby Weber, he was so impressed by her, and he did a show with me about that, and I didn't know what it was going to be, and I was really shocked that he was coming up with the idea that Eichmann was working for the Israelis, working for the Jews all along. He maybe was a Jew. And it was to find fault with the Adenauer government, and the Adenauer government cooperating with the Israelis and the Jews to whatever they were doing. Now I can't really bring it all up to mind, but I didn't see any value in that at the time, and he was totally thought that that was a line to follow. And so I just questioned the way he thought about things. And in the end, he says that he questions everything. He doesn't believe anything. He doesn't, He doesn't accept anything finally at all. I don't think there's anything that he finally accepts. Because he's very prone to seeing it as being some kind of conspiracy or not being what it appears to be. So in this case, he joins in here and he says that Borgestick, he writes, I'm also puzzled about Hitler's fate. As you point out, what is presented as evidence for his demise is bogus. The Russians lying again. Wilf doesn't think much of the Russians, but later on he uses the Russians as evidence for some of what he wants, what he believes. But he says that he mentions a Russian document with a German voice over. A Russian documentary that was made, a video with German voiceover that he watched. And in this, they say that he moved to Antarctica. This was proposing that Hitler went to Antarctica. And there's a whole thing about Hitler going to Antarctica and all the guys with him. And they set up their new Nazi regime there. And that's the picture that I used. It's so crazy. But then he says that maybe not that. There's a book by Abel Basti, Jan van Helsing, who have him living in Argentine, as does your source. And he mentions this book. And the title of it is Hitler Survived in Argentine. Now, he says, but then he says about this book, nothing to write home about. All of it is based on hearsay. But nevertheless, with three question marks after that, well, what kind of thinking is that for a revisionist? It's all based on hearsay, but still, it might be true. So let's keep our mind open about it. I have a little bit of a problem with that. And then he says, having said that, I find it hard to believe that Third Reich dignitaries did not have a contingency plan worked out. Well, all right. You know, this is really beneath Wilf Hank's intelligence to say something like this. How would they have, maybe Hitler didn't want to go to Argentine. You know, I mean, he didn't. So, and they didn't, and maybe there was no way they could make a plan like that. They didn't control the world, you know. So, you know, the truth is that many, what he calls dignitaries or big people in the Third Reich, who had access to Hitler, urged him in the last month or 2 months, but especially in the last month, to go south, first to Berchtesgaden, in where he had his home, and then they would go further and they would, you know, find some way to get away. And there was a lot of them who wanted him to do that. But he refused. He refused, and he was in control. He was not their slave. Because these people wanted him to do this doesn't mean that they could force him to do it. You know, Hitler had his own personal aides who were totally avowed to do what he, you know, to protect him and do his bidding. They had pistols. They were around him. He had the Adolf Hitler, the SS Adolf Hitler, regiment. It was more than a regiment, the division, that were, specially, I can't come over the word now, you know, especially there to take care of him and to protect him, and they are outside of the bunker. They would do anything he asked them. They would never do anything he wouldn't allow them to do, which is one reason he didn't want to go outside, because if he was injured, he knew that, and he asked them to shoot him, he didn't think they would do it. He didn't know if anyone would have the nerve or the ability to actually shoot him. Anyway, that's a different story. But these people who say that, they must have had a plan. Well, the plan would come from Hitler. And Hitler was uncertain what he wanted to do up until maybe around 10 days or so before the last day, before his suicide. Something, I can't say for sure, I didn't check that out, but more or less something like that, when he decided, made a firm decision and said he told everybody, I'm going to shoot myself when the time comes, you know, when there's no more, when they're so close and there's no more hope left, because he's always holding out hope for some miracle to happen. They didn't like that, of course, because they did see him as the Führer. He was the Führer, and they wanted the Führer to survive. They wanted to, you know, shuttle him off somewhere, but he wouldn't do it. And it makes absolutely perfect sense that he would not do it, that he would want to end his life there. Now, so Wilf says here in this Kodo thread, after he says that he finds it hard to believe that the Third Reich dignitaries did not have a contingency plan, he says, but then for some of us, Hitler could not have escaped. It would lessen his hero status and open a can of worms. Well, he's always a little bit knocking at the hero status. He doesn't really like Hitler that much. Sometimes he does. He talks about it. And other times his old feelings come back, and he really he doesn't want to. He wants to question everything, including Hitler. And if you are a person who no longer questions that Hitler was the honorable, good person that so many of us know he was, he finds that kind of a problem for him. He doesn't want to go that far. So anyway, he then later on another post, Wilf says, further, all I'm saying here is that there is no evidence for Hitler's demise. So, and there's those three question marks again. And then fact is we are being lied to continually. So this is Wilf's state of mind, that nothing is certain. We're being lied to. So everything, even the things that we think are not lies now, can be lies too. And I really find that a difficult position. It's not my position. If I thought I couldn't trust anything or anybody, and everything was up for question, that's not the way I think. But it is the way he thinks. So that's why he's open to this silly story about Hitler escaping from the bunker. And he says, I just find it hard to understand that for some, it is important that Hitler died in his bunker. Why? And this is what some of these people, this is the attitude some of them have who want to entertain these escape stories, that they feel like Hitler's being made into a hero that he shouldn't be. And he is seen, you know, his end is seen in a way that they don't like. And so it's kind of a dig, that what he said here is kind of the same, similar to the dig from above. And he's talking about people like me and if not me. So I will answer that question. Why is it important that Hitler died in his bunker? Well, what's important is the truth. Well, what's important is the truth. If you're convinced that that's the truth, then you're going to stand by that. But it's not about making certain this happened to Hitler and something else didn't happen to Hitler. It's about what you think is the truth. And it's so evident that the truth is that he ended his life in the bunker. But going on, I won't say some of this. I'll say those who think that Hitler could have hid away in Argentina without being tracked, I think I already said this, by combined Allied agents, they're living in La La Land. I mean, and he knew that. You see, he knew more than these other people did. They had hopes of survival. He felt very bad that he didn't think most of them would survive. And of course, those who did survive were murdered later after the Nuremberg trials and so on. So he was right, and they would have been better off had they done suicide back when and not gone through all that imprisonment and that horrible, stupid trial and then being hung and so on. But that never would have worked. None of these stories about Hitler hiding away somewhere would ever have, it never would have lasted very long at all if it did happen. Now, Wilf says, let the chips fall where they may, you know, in looking into this. Well, he talks like that. But then this other poster, Min Kuo, I don't know, that's how I pronounce it, he said he doesn't know what happened, but from a psychological point of view, I'm inclined to think he died in the bunker. He says the defeat, he understands that the defeat of Germany and National Socialism was also the loss of purpose for Hitler to live, oh, something to live for, which is true. And then he says, makes a good point. He says, if Hitler had escaped and lived hidden somewhere, it seems reasonable that he should have written some books and memories, some autographs, and he means some memoirs. Finally, we should have some convincing documents or photos. And that's true. There should be something, but there isn't anything. So it's funny that they say, because there's no proof, they don't have the bodies of the two, of the couple, that they, that therefore they can believe these other stories where they don't have anything to base it on. But in these books, they show you a lot of stuff, which doesn't prove anything, but they show it to you so people get the idea that there's something there. Then he talks about that they should have planned the graves better, because they just put them in that shallow grave, and he thought that they would have, planned that for a better grave. But he sort of says that they would have taken the bodies somewhere else and buried them properly. But there was no way you could have buried those bodies, that it wouldn't have been found out, and they would have gone and dug them up, and then they would have had them. So what Adolf Hitler wanted, and what he instructed his people there to do, was as soon as they were dead, to take them up out right outside the bunker. They didn't have too many options, you know. The Russians were already there. Burn them, you know, in some... And they just used bomb craters, these guys, rather than dig some ditches. They used some bomb craters that were already there. But to burn their bodies, and he instructed his personal aide to instruct this his driver to go and collect gasoline for the purpose. And he expected them to do this. Well, they did it, but they didn't do as good a job as they should have. And I think it's because they were in shock. They weren't sure they could believe that he was actually going to do this. And they didn't want him to do it, and they didn't like it, and so they didn't prepare as well as they should have, but he gave them instructions, and he trusted they would do it. That's all he could do, really. Now, he couldn't see that it was done himself, because he was already gonna be dead, he and Ava, so he had to trust in them. Now, Wilf comes back and says, this is not too important, so I think I'll skip this, about a Time magazine article. He's using an investigation by Russian criminologists, where above he said that the Russians were always liars. Oh, and he says that this Time magazine investigation mentions a movable concrete slab in Hitler's private room in the bunker. Okay, and behind this slab, there was a passage, man high, leading into a secret room 500 meters on. Another tunnel then led to a subway line. Well, this is very possible, because when they built these bunkers, they made other exits besides how, you know, the regular going in to go back out the same way. They made some secret exits, and in case they wanted to leave in some kind of an emergency, and this passage was led to a subway line. Well, now at the end there. When Hitler supposedly made his escape, what was he going to do? Go through that tunnel and get on a subway? You know, I mean, some of this is just kind of silly if you think that this means anything. It doesn't mean anything. Now, this, I have to mention here Stephen Willow, who has a frequent poster there at CODA and Forum. And, you know, all these people consider themselves revisionists. I don't mean they're all known revisionists. Stephen Willow is a pseudonym, and he's got some picture there of a German guy for his Atavar. So, but he believes this. He's fine, and he usually speaks fairly intelligently, but he falls into this. He says that, why? He says he finds it unlikely that Adolf Hitler would have used the cowardly method of suicide, when he could have died with the rifle in his hand fighting against an enemy. Well, in the first place, suicide was not considered cowardly, and I don't consider it cowardly. and it has never been considered cowardly throughout our traditional history. But he doesn't seem to understand that. And some of, I don't know who some of these people are. They might not even be white people, some of them. So, but Stephen Willow really likes Adolf Hitler. That's for sure. And certainly Hitler could not have died with a rifle in his hand fighting against an enemy. I mean, he was in no shape to go out and fight. He was not in good shape then at all. He was in poor health. I mean, you have to face up to these things. Willow seems to want to make him into a hero. Maybe that kind that Wilf was saying he had to make him into, you have to make him into a hero. But, one thing important, he said, Willow, that's really far off. He says, nor can one accept the notion that Adolf Hitler would have used his beloved dog to test the poison, that he planned to use. Well, he did do that when he was suddenly became uncertain whether the poison capsules that Himmler had given him, once Himmler had betrayed him, he felt, they then doubted that the poison capsules were any good. And so he tested it on his dog, Blondie. Well, you know what? It was like the day before. And what do you think was going to happen to that dog? That dog was going to be put down. And so he just did it that way. And it was still hard for him. But, you know, Blondie had had puppies. And those puppies were put down shortly before the end. What were they going to do? Leave these animals there to have the Russians adopt them or something? Or have them running around loose and get out and run around out there with all the bombs and fire and so on? I mean, you don't do that. You have to protect those you love and those who you care for. Everybody was either going to try to escape or they were going to commit suicide and if they didn't make it, they still had their poison capsule that they could commit suicide then, if they were hurt or if they were caught or something. So this was all planned out. This was planned out very well. But dogs can't escape, and dogs can't make decisions like that. So you have to take care of those dogs yourself. So, you know, the Goebbels gave these poison capsules to their own children because they didn't want them to fall into the hands of the enemy. And I think this is, you know, this is what I would do. I mean, I don't know about my children, but I would always commit suicide before I'd fall into the hands of my enemy. Because being in the hands of your enemy when it's that bad of an enemy is worse than, far worse than death. So, and he talks about, he says some silly things about Hitler and how Hitler would have never capitulated to torture and would have exposed the hoax. And so just ridiculous stuff. Now, Borgestick comes back and says, after a few things, he says, I disagree that Hitler wouldn't have tried to escape because Saddam Hussein and Idi Amin, they wanted to survive, and Hitler would have wanted to also. And I'm certain Hitler escaped simply because after 70 years, the Allies have not proved that he died. Okay, well, you know, there were all kinds of witnesses in the bunker who saw what happened, and nobody watched him actually die, but they saw him dead. And they swore to it, they said it, but, you know, still that's witness testimony. But Borgestick says, as for staying to serve his race and nation, what race and nation? Germany was totally and royally F.EK after the war. That is, you know, screwed royally after the war. Well, Borgestick unfortunately sounds too proud when he says that. He's happy about that. It makes him feel good. But at the same time, he says, as for staying to serve his race and nation, nobody said he was going to stay alive to serve. He stayed in the bunker, not to serve, but just to stay there until the end and go down with the nation, you know, as the nation went down. So, we have more about Hitler's honor and stuff, but my conclusion, all right, I did get through this. My conclusion is that, there's never going to be any end to the nonsense spouted wherever it can be. And I'm surprised that these people on Kodo Forum, who I thought had more sense, were entertaining this story about Hitler's escape. And wherever this stuff goes, it infects the minds of the gullible or the lazy, and they waste their time, they waste their money, and they don't get close to the truth because they're engaged in fantasy and this science fiction stuff. Well, that's why I say that you're not going to change that about people. And therefore, the only real change can come from political change. And when you get the forces of truth to enforce the truthful version of history on everyone, right now we have the forces of untruth. Well, of course, people are going to argue which is the force, which is the truth and which is the untruth. And that's not going to change either. That's why it's all comes down to political power. When you get the political power, you take over, and then you are controlling what children learn in school. You are controlling what comes out of the media. You are controlling all of that. There's no way to have a really free, a libertarian-type free society and not have a bunch of lies take charge or have things. The average people don't make good decisions about things like this. They're too prone to entertainment. So I'm just saying that that if, you know, whatever it is, if you strongly believe it, you have to work for that politically and get political power if you want to make that the general the general truth that people are getting. Whether you want to call it truth or something else, doesn't matter. It's the information, what people generally believe, what is the, say, the narrative of your nation or your people or your world. Okay, we'll be back in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. vermisse dich. Und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and that was band Sleipnir. I'm sorry, if I don't have the word in front of me, I can't even remember how to say it. And I don't even know if that's right, but I'll get that straight. All right, I'm going to turn now, right on schedule here, to a thread on the VNN forum about... I'm really going to be reading, I'm really going to be just taking parts from the post by Greg Johnson. And the reason I'm doing this is based on what I was talking about in the beginning of the show, that we're having quite a discussion about white nationalism and Holocaust, or Holocaust revisionism, and how they fit together, and what is encouraging to some of us is that this is the first time these two areas of knowledge, you might say, and important areas for white people, have been talked about in connection with one another. And it's bringing out a lot of white nationalists who are very adamant about Holocaust revisionism and the importance of it, and that we should not turn away from it in any way, shape, or form, but should go after it directly, because they think that is the real weak spot, the biggest weak spot in the Jewish power structure, for a lot of reasons. So, and I agree with that too. It's not the only weak spot, but it's a very important one, and it might be the most important one, and maybe the easiest one to attack and to make a headway with. So this is an important discussion. So there has been a very interesting thread on VNN Forum, and this thread is titled, Eric Hunt Says Johnson, McDonald, Jared Taylor, and Mark Weber Conspire to Seed Jews' Holocaust Big Lie. A long title, but it has kind of taken off from that beginning. That was the first post, but it's now 18 pages, and I'm going to start in this 18 page discussion on page 8. I think it's with post number 150. So it's already 150 comments in. So, and this is when it gets most interesting for me, And in post 150 on page, I believe it's on page 8, we have Greg Johnson responding to Alex Linder. And here he's just responding to the charge that there aren't enough original articles on Countercurrents. This is Greg Johnson's website, Countercurrents. And it is, there are a lot of them are reprints, and Greg, this is not too important. And Greg comes back and says that he checked them all out and found that there were of the total number that they had published 1,894 pieces at Countercurrents, 739 were tagged original, and 663 were tagged reprints. So he says it's not over half, or it's not most of them, and that's a big lie. Well, but I found it kind of shocking that almost half were reprints, almost half, and the others were original. But certainly that would be wrong to say that it's mostly reprints. So that's all that was about. But in that particular message that Greg wrote, he denies the half claim. And he says, but the worst of it is that such claims are advanced without even bothering to ascertain their truth, in complete indifference to truth, simply to smear. And these are the sorts of scum who defend the intellectual integrity of Holocaust revisionism. Well, this claim came from Hadding Scott, who said that a friend of his had told him that this friend had just said that he used to like Countercurrents, but after reading it for a while, he realized that most of what he was reading was reprints and not original work. And that's where that comment came from. And then Greg Johnson took a lot of offense to it. And so here he is, for the first time that I know, bringing in words like scum. I mean, bringing in, he talks about people smearing him, and then he's smearing by saying that people are indifferent to the truth. People are smearing him, and he says these sorts of scum who defend the intellectual integrity of Holocaust revisionism. He's tying this in with Holocaust revisionists being the scummy people, and he says, forgive me for not stooping to respond to this sort of crap. To this sort of crap, smearmongers, another word he uses to label the people he's talking about. Smearmongers can generate lies 10 times faster than I can refute them, and I have better things to do with my time. Then he goes on to say, let's have another debate. Are Carolyn Yeager and Hadding Scott paid by our enemies to smear their betters and create a madhouse atmosphere that guarantees that our cause remains marginal? Are you kidding? Nobody is smearing him. And all of a sudden he brings me in. Now, as I said earlier, I'm not a member of BNN. I don't post there. I had never posted anything on this thread. I'm only reading it, but I'm finding myself brought up in it by Greg Johnson. So Greg Johnson is tying me with Hadding Scott as going after him. And are we paid by the enemies of white nationalism to do this? It's all ridiculous. And then he uses the word betters, he's our betters. And anybody associated with him is our betters. And then he says, are they being paid to do this, or are they doing it for free because they have personality disorders? So there's tons of attacks in this. There's tons of, now I can't think of that word, ad hominems. There's tons of ad hominems in here. Well, nobody used any ad hominems toward him. Well, I certainly have never. I have everything I've written about Greg Johnson, except in some of those comments on TOO, which wouldn't have all been quotes, but everything I've written about him, I have quoted from him. It's his own words. But he has never once quoted what I have said. He's never once said, Carolyn Yeager said this, And that's why I accuse her of these things. Never, never, never use it. Because, see, there's nothing for him to use. I've never said anything against him in that way, in a way that would be. I've never said anything untruthful about him, let's say that. So, after that on page 8, he says, here's my new right and old right essay, and he links to that essay that he wrote about new right and old right, which Hanning Scott has criticized quite a lot, along with some other people. But he says that he's defending himself by saying it's possible to coin new words and redefine old ones. The problem there is that that he's been criticized for is that old right, that he is making, he's making new definitions for old right and new right. There's always been an old right, and there's been something called the new right, but he has come up with a way of looking at those in a different light, his own way. He's made his own distinction about those. So he says it's possible to coin new words and redefine old ones, and the real question of substance is, does the distinction make sense as I have defined it? I believe that it does. So if he within his essay makes sense with old right and new right, he says it doesn't matter if they have other meanings outside of his essay. In his essay, that's what they mean, and so he can do that. Now, he then says that the European New Right was born in the late 60s, but the word was invented by the press, not by the New Rightists. And he says that the New Right amounts to being a repudiation of the old rights, characteristic means one-party politics, totalitarianism, terrorism, imperialism, genocide, etc. Now, if you are someone who is faithful to what he calls the old right, that's a lot of name calling right there. Totalitarianism, terrorism, imperialism, genocide. He doesn't want any of that. And he says that they did. And he says by old right, I mean the National Socialist and fascist tradition that the new right obviously emerges from. Now, this is kind of old stuff, but just follow me along here. He says the new right has the same basic values, goals, and intellectual framework of the old right, but they repudiate the characteristic means in favor of the transfer. They repudiate the means that the old right used in favor of what he calls the transformation of culture and consciousness. Well, we is, of course, him. Greg Johnson and whoever goes along with him, would say that they are part of this North American New Right that Greg has created. Now, here he comes back now, though. He's still writing the same long message here on VNN. Now he comes back to his name calling. He says, we are not tied to the past as much as both our enemies and our would-be friends, the NS cultists and crypt keepers, like Hadding, would like us to be. Well, he's really got it in for Hadding, because Hadding has continued to criticize him. So he's calling Hadding an NS, a National Socialist cultist, and a crypt keeper. Well, what's a crypt keeper? That's tending to the dead. You're tending to the crypts. And so he's saying that National Socialism from just 70 years ago, you know, from the 20s and 30s and 40s is culty, and it's like crypt, it's dead, it's gone, nobody should have any interest in it, but Hadding does. So then he says the fact is that old rightists like you and William Pierce, now he's talking to Alex, the fact is that old rightists like you, Alex Linder, and William Pierce do want to commit genocide against Jews, and no doubt other groups as well. So now he's really getting angry, and he's coming out with the fact that he's accusing people of wanting to commit genocide and wanting to genocide the Jews. Now, he wants, obviously, he's saying here that That's something he would never do. He's making it clear that he doesn't want to genocide anyone, and he does certainly doesn't want to genocide the Jews. And I've had some other people accuse me and anybody who's in favor of or likes National Socialism of wanting to genocide the Jews. That's something that they're starting to say now. And he says, I think it's worth debating, this is still Greg, I think it's worth debating whether Hadding trolls for pay or for free. So this comes up again. Because he gets some twisted psychological satisfaction from this, the same goes for Carolyn. All right, he's calling us trolls. Well, he's including me in there. Of course, I don't troll. I'm not on VNN. I wrote a few comments on TOO for his article. But I do write and say things on the White Network comments pages, because that's where I do my most of my writing, most of my commenting. So I kind of don't get involved in other places now because I don't have time to comment everywhere. Plus, I just haven't done it for a long time. It makes your life easier when you're not always out there writing comments that are controversial, and then you get caught up in back and forth with people, which goes on and on. So, but anyway, there's no way I can be a troll for one reason. One thing, I mean, I use my own name. I'm not, I'm not a hidden person. I'm not somebody who's just coming on somewhere and throwing stuff out there to disrupt the discussion. I'm talking from my heartfelt beliefs all the time. So we'll go on to number 159. This is post number 159. I think it's might still be on page 8. This was a busy page for Greg. And I lost 159. I wonder if it's... No, I lost it. So I can't do that one. I was cleaning this thing up, and obviously I went from... I can go to that page. I can go to... Well, I'll wait a minute here. I'll go to... Here I'm on number 237. This was 6 days ago. This is on page 12. This might be all the time I have anyway. He says, Hadding Scott, he's talking about Hadding. I don't have any of this bolded. He's talking about things that Hadding has said about him and Guillaume Fay, and he said that he's taking his ideas from Guillaume Fay's New Jewish Question, but he says he didn't even read the book, so he read a review of it and didn't care much for it, so he didn't even read the book. So that makes Hadding wrong. But he says the main problem with Hadding's thesis is that I had never read those quotes before he posted them online. I assume they come from the New Jewish Question, but I never read that book. Okay, that's what... I already said that. Then he goes on to say, number two, his item number two, Alex and Carolyn Yeager are all a flutter about the fact that we have created a nonprofit Countercurrents Foundation. Well, what happened was I wrote that in my article, Everything Greg Johnson Knows About the Holocaust He Learned from Mark Weber, which has gotten a huge number of hits, a huge number of readers. And this, I'm sure that this somehow Greg Johnson understands that. And so he is really angry at me for writing this, and he has to answer a lot of things. And what I said at the end of this was that, and I was correct, absolutely correct, that he has applied for 501c3 status. Now, Greg, I know, doesn't know how I learned that, because that hadn't been made public, but I did learn it, and I wrote it in there. I didn't have proof, but I was sure it was true enough, and I would find out. anyway, he said, and then Alex posted that whole article on I think in this thread. Yeah, in this thread. And then he was talking about this 501c3, which that Greg Johnson's Countercurrents is going after, and he was really interested in this, and he had a lot to say about it. You know, I've lost a whole bunch of my listeners who must not like what I'm talking about right now. I'm sorry about that, folks, but I'm going to continue. And therefore, so Greg is responding to this, and he is saying a lot of things that he is explaining why he's doing the 501c3. He says we have plenty of loyal supporters who are quite radical, because Linder was saying that the reason that he has done this, that he's doing this, is to get more money and get more supporters with money and so on. And he's wanting to become less radical so he can get more supporters who might be turned off by if he's too strong for white nationalism. Yeah. And so Greg is saying that they have plenty of radical supporters, and that he's doing this because they deserve a break on their taxes, and since they're going to donate to them, if they get a break on their taxes, they would be in a position to give more money. So Greg has got big plans for his organization. And then he says, it brings me up again, and he says, Carolyn claims that Mark Weber is advising us on how to get 501c3 status, presumably by advising us to ditch revisionism. Well, I didn't actually say that at all. I just said that they were that they had the same view on ditching revisionism. I don't really remember what I said, but I may have said that. But Mark Weber was, my information was that Mark Weber was giving him some advice on this. And then he said that Carolyn did not even know that much. She was just making it up to fit her conspiracy narrative. Well, I wasn't making it up. I did know about it. But you see, so you know, he's wrong there. But then he says that Mark Weber's article on the relevance of revisionism did influence my thinking on this matter. So now he admits it, whereas before he said, you know, I was just making something up. But my whole article was that everything that Greg Johnson had said came from Mark Weber. And he says, well, now he says, okay, Mark Weber did influence my thinking. Well, he better admit it, because it's clear from reading the two men's, those two articles by those two men. So, and then he says, but so did Jonathan Bowden, and so did a learned gentleman whom I did not name because he's not a public figure and I respect people's privacy. Well, you know what I say? There's not a bit of truth in that statement. Why would he say a... He adds that because he wants to spread his thinking about Holocaust revisionism from Mark Weber to some other people. So he throws in Jonathan Bowden, who is no expert on it. And then he adds some learned gentleman whom he doesn't name. Well, of course, you know, I mean, he could name him, but he doesn't name him. And he gives the excuse that, well, he's not a public figure. Well, why would... And he doesn't, and he respects his privacy. Well, you know, I mean, how much truth would that, you know, why would anybody believe that? I think he just put that all together to make it sound like he didn't get it all from Weber, which is what I said. So, you know, this is just these little tricks which show that somebody is not being really on the up and up, that somebody's playing games and is always trying to, swerve around from any criticism and turn it back on the people who are making it, when the criticism, a lot of criticism, is valid. And instead of listening to it, he's trying to get out of every single bit of it. So now he says his point number four, he now says, well, Mark Weber is a person I do business with. Regarding Weber, I did some editing for him. He has sold our books. I have sold his books. We have spoken at one another's events, etc. Our conversations deal with publishing, book selling, the Jewish question, movement politics, and personalities, and the Third Reich. Well, I imagine they talk quite a bit. I know from people, so many people saying so, that Mark Weber loves to talk on the phone with people and will spend all day talking on the phone with people. And I have people who have said to me, not now, they wouldn't say it to me now anymore, but in the past, they said to me, well, I spent hours talking with Mark Weber, and I spent hours talking on the phone together. Hours! And that's just one person, and he talks to a lot of people. And I can believe this because there was a time when I was, there was a big hullabaloo going on that Paul Grubach started about Mark Weber a few years ago. And I got involved in that a little bit, and I was also critical of Weber. And then Weber sent me an email and asked me to, with his phone number, wanted me to call him so we could talk about it. You see, I never called him because I knew that I had no desire to work anything out with him, and I thought that he would just be trying to smooth talk me. I understand he's a very good talker. He's very good conversationalist and so on, and always sounds real reasonable and all. So I really didn't want to subject myself to that. But he wanted to do it, and this is the way he operates. He operates on the telephone, I think. But anyway, Greg Johnson says that, then he puts in parentheses, I might have discussed revisionism proper with Weber once in 2002. He said it was at, he doesn't remember, he honestly can't remember any details. And maybe it was someone else, but it was at an AMREN meeting. Okay, so, you know, they all go to these AMREN meetings, and they meet each other at these places. They go to each other's meetings, and they meet, and they do business together, and they gossip and talk together, and they kind of network together, and maybe they even bond a little bit, which is supposed to be good for the white nationalist movement, but I'm not so sure, because these people become friends with one another and defend one another and cooperate with one another, and nobody's going to tell on the other guy or say anything critical. So there's no criticism that needs to be going on. There's none going on. It's just I'll pat your back, you pat my back. That's the way I see this. I don't really see it as very useful networking, I'm sorry to say. So then Greg continues in this same long post. I'm putting this out here, he says, because it is, that is how he knows Weber and so on. Because it is illustrative of how Alex, he's including Alex Linder here, the administrator of the forum, Alex, Carolyn, and Hadding think. They come up with a story and then make the facts fit, or make up facts to fit, because deep down they are indifferent to the truth, even if they could learn it. This is pretty strong for him to say about Alex Linder, who he's always getting on his, he's always trying to get his approval. And the reason is because he once had Alex Linder's approval. Alex Linder was a big fan of Greg Johnson some time back, and now he's changing his mind, and now Greg Johnson is conflicted about whether to, he's trying to get Alex back on his side, but at the same time, he can't help but attack those who criticize him. He really can't take the criticism, and he'll go after him. So now, you know, he's saying that Alex Linder is indifferent to the truth. I mean, it's one thing to say that Hadding and I are. He's always talking like that about Hadding, and he can throw me to the wolves any, you know, in any way he wants to, but he should be a little more careful about Alex, but he's not. So then he goes on to say, well, I'm just going to read this because he says, even if they could learn the truth, they're indifferent to it. Indifference to the truth is not the same thing as healthy skepticism about matters one just cannot know about for sure. So he has healthy skepticism, but the three of us have indifference to the truth. These are matters of easily verified fact, he says. Well, I want to throw in here a matter that should be easily verified, a matter of fact that should be, is where Greg Johnson got his PhD. You know, I'm still asking that question, and he has not answered it. And I got a very good email from someone the other day on this subject, and he said, this is the person who wrote to me. This person said, a person who's not involved in this whole dispute at all, but said, the whole point of a doctorate is that it is a qualification in a particular discipline or pseudo-discipline. Well, this person thinks of university disciplines as pseudo-disciplines. I think that's why they said that. I'll just say a particular discipline from a particular institution. Apart from Dr. Feelgood, if a person does not say what their supposed doctorate is in and where it was granted, earned, then they cannot be referred to as doctor. Well, Deanna Spingola should, I hope she's listening to this, so she'll stop calling Greg Johnson doctor. Greg Johnson goes on and says, but they are not interested in that. That means us three. We are not interested in easily verified fact. Well, I would be, you know. But he says, if they were, they would behave differently. Thus, it seems reasonable to conclude that they have different agendas than just the truth. So this is the way Greg Johnson is writing here. He's got nothing in particular to say. It's just all these put downs and trying to say, well, he's standing for the truth, but we're not. Now, he says, now when people who reason like this defend a field like Holocaust revisionism, doesn't that constitute grounds for skepticism about revisionism itself? You see how he attacks revisionism. He says that that we are people who because we don't want the truth, because we're indifferent to the truth and all these things, and we are defending Holocaust revisionism, that constitutes grounds for skepticism about revisionism itself. He says revisionists really need to police their publicists and fanboys with friends like these. Three dots, you know, that's how he ended that one. With friends like these, meaning we don't need any enemies. So this is really classic, and I call it homosexual sicko nastiness. I mean, this is just Greg Johnson revealed so much about himself in that I have to remember to look at my email. I'm just looking now. Greg Johnson revealed so much about himself in the countercurrents comments. Now in this VNN thread, he is revealing even more. And, you know, in a forum, you really let your hair down a little bit more. And it's doesn't look very good. Doesn't look very good. I've got some more stuff here, but it's not, let me refresh if I can do it, and refresh my email, see if there's anything here, because I forgot to look. I'll go back this way. Go back here. But here's something. Here's something from someone. Oh, this is Hadding. He says, not most of what he was reading, but most of what my friend found worthwhile on countercurrents was old material. He's correcting me here, as he does. He's so good at correcting. And by the way, Hadding Scott and Hadding didn't even know I was going to do this. I mean, he had no part in this. I just came up with this actually yesterday and today. He's not helping me put it together or anything like that. But he says here, he's making the point, yeah, that what his friend said was that what he found worthwhile on countercurrents was old material. That's why, and he says that he stopped donating to Greg Johnson at countercurrents, because after he was reading it for a while, he found that what he liked, everything that he liked, was old material, was the reprints. And the new stuff, he didn't care for it too much. So that's a very important point. Hadding is right, a very important point to make. Because I'm just kind of jumping around in these posts. There's so many of them that I miss a little bit of these finer shades. Then he says, what is worthwhile is a matter of opinion, of course. That's right, whatever his friend thought was most worthwhile. Then he said, there was no basis for Greggy to call me a liar on that. He says, it's not as if Greg never lost a donor. I don't know, but I imagine if he's had a lot of donors for a while, he's probably lost a few. Now, I want to point out here something that Alex Linder wrote in this thread. This was yesterday. It was number 347, post number 347 of this thread. Well, that's not as many as 758 that was on the Occidental Observer, is it? But then this is a smaller group here, a smaller group of people who post here. And I thought it was just very, very good. And I want to quote this. It was an answer to something that Lou wrote. Lou, L-E-W. He commented on the T-O-O big thread, big comment section, and he's commented. Well, he's even come to the White Network and commented. And he's commenting here on VNN forum. And he made, at the end of one of his comments, he said, people's choices really come down to these. Support an existing project, effort, or organization, or start your own if you're not happy with an existing one. I don't know what all he was saying there, but it was kind of like, if you're unhappy with what people are doing, start something of your own. Sometimes that's not as feasible as it is to try to correct the one that's already there, you know. And I think this is what Linder has in mind when he responded and said about himself, my project is destroying people, ideas, groups that lead brains and talent away from the correct strategy and that necessarily involves intense criticism of others. The point of virtual infighting is to produce one dominant tendency around which opposition to Zog can crystallize. Well, virtual infighting, if you don't get that, would be what we're doing, you know, on the internet, on this forum, in these comments sections, where what I'm doing even right here now, where some people have left because they don't like it, I imagine, because they say, well, this is infighting, and I hate this infighting, but if we can either, well, what Linder's going to say here is we can either fight for real or we can do this virtual fighting, which can help us to prevent some real fighting. So he says, really, this fighting should be done on the street. He's a believer in real life street work, but he says, but since no one is doing that yet, it is working itself out online. He says, this is what politics is, debating the right way to go. Then he says, the middle class fetish for being nice and staying positive and pretending we can all get along is foolish and wrong. In the real world, there is a large opportunity cost to going the wrong way. That is, I don't know why he uses opportunity, but there's a large cost to go the wrong way. You're right. And there's a cost in opportunity too, because you lose opportunities when you go the wrong way. If you have an opportunity, I see what he's saying. If you have an opportunity and then you take the wrong direction when that opportunity comes up, you lose that opportunity. And opportunities don't come up all the time. So that's very good wording there. So then he continues, so if the false direction can be corrected with a few days of words, so much the better. I think that is just, that makes me think really highly of Alex Linder, that he comes up with that. I don't have time to read everything everybody says, and I don't always, it's not always put in a way that I like, I guess. But this really struck me when I read it yesterday, I guess it was. And you know, the idea that we should always be nice and stay positive and pretend we can all get along, he says is foolish and wrong. Well, of course, we don't all get along. We're never going to all get along. We're always going to be disagreeing on things. But some of these major disagreements we can work out in this in these forums and in these virtual situations on the internet, and it's good. It's not bad. Like, what came from that article that Greg Johnson wrote, and I do have to give him credit for writing that and starting all this. He does come out with things that are, he doesn't always hold back, you know. He's not always trying to be nice and pretending we can all get along. So he comes out with stuff, and then we all have something. In this case, we all had something to use to say, well, what do I think of this? And I believe in this, and other people believed in others. So we see where our difference is, and now we have this connection going on with Holocaust revisionism, or Holo Hoax revisionism, and white nationalism, which really was nowhere before. So this is a very good thing. And I have strong feelings about things, and so I think I should say what they are. I like people who come right out and say what they think. So all these people who are calling each other names, I like all of them. I'm not done with what Linda has to say here. That was all very good. Now he continues with another sentence. He says, if Greg Johnson is going the wrong way, then he should be attacked in the harshest terms, the better to correct him or to persuade people who might otherwise follow him. So, you know, right. And I think this is very National Socialist. And I wonder if Linda realizes that this is National Socialist or thinks that it is. But he says, if Greg Johnson is going the wrong way, Alex Linder thinks he is, then he should be attacked in the harshest terms. You can't be soft and nice, or it's not going to have any effect. You have to tear into the person so that they pay attention. And our own people, you know, amongst ourselves, we need to do that. We need to attack what we think is the wrong way amongst ourselves. And not just, you know, well, I don't need to keep repeating it, but this is what a lot of people think, that you should not do this. And Linder says this is the better to correct him or to persuade people who might otherwise follow him. So if you have a clear idea, as Alex Linder does, about what is the right way and what is the wrong way, you should speak it out. And it's good that Greg Johnson comes on to BNN Forum, which he has, not a lot because he doesn't even have 100 posts yet to his credit, but he comes on now and then. And it is true that Linder said that sometime back, I don't know how long it would have been, maybe not even a year ago, he was singing the praises of Greg Johnson. But now this whole affair has shown him a different Greg Johnson. And it took him a while. He kept saying, well, he couldn't understand why Greg was doing what he's doing. He must be confused. And he was saying he was getting bad advice from some other white nationalists. But now he's seeing that it's just Greg, and he's changing his mind, and he's sorry what he sees. But all these things, yeah, all these things do need to be brought out, because this tells us who's who and where's where, and it helps us to clarify our ideas. It really does. So let me go back to my other page now, because I'm done with that. And I do have a little time to talk about building white consciousness. Although I hadn't thought about it much, because I didn't think I would, so I might be a little slow about this. But I got some ideas yesterday about it, before I went on to these other topics. And first, I think, to build white consciousness, this is just a few ideas I'm going to put forth, and then we'll talk more. I'll talk more about it next week with some other people. The first thing is that we need to emphasize white values and distinguish them from non-white values. There's nothing new in this. Let me get a drink of water here. But it is crucial, and most whites, I think, that aren't that are awake to racial reality, want to say that all humans have similar values. They call them human values, and they think, you know, we all have the same values. Thus they become patsies for Negroes or Indians, like these Indians from India, to take advantage of them and to live with them, go to school with them, or even mestizo Indians, the mestizos that are part Indian. You know, they say, well, they're the same as we are. And we racialists know that they are not, but these other whites people, our fellow whites, have been taught that that is a wrong and a bad way to think, and so they don't want to think that. You know, when I talk to a few white people who are pretty kind of aware, not really racially aware, but they fall for this 100%, and they would be totally uncomfortable. They are totally uncomfortable by pointing out differences that we shouldn't all get along and we can't all live together, even though these people don't associate with any of these non-whites. They only associate with whites. And they know that that's natural. They think, well, that's the way we can all live together, you know, in the same communities and so on, but we associate with those who are like ourselves, and, you know, they don't really question that too much. But if you would say that these others are making the community less attractive, less hospitable, less enjoyable, they would deny that, and they don't want to go there. So this is something that we have to make clear about values. And then the normal or the normative is also important in building white consciousness. We strive for white, heterosexual, able-bodied. That's the normal. That should be the normative. And things that don't fit that are something to simply question. I mean, that's not what we want. We don't want homosexual, and we don't want people who aren't able-bodied. We don't want a whole bunch people what do you call that when you have one thing or another wrong with you, so you can't do anything. And we get more and more and more of those. So these three things I think are important to bring, and they're hard. It's hard because it sounds cruel. It sounds cruel to think like this. Well, here's something that I came upon. I'll just read it because I thought it was interesting. And I don't have anything marked in it. I just have to read the thing. So I will. A student in my American, this was something I found on the internet. I was looking for white consciousness. And of course, all I find is stuff, websites that have something that is anti-white consciousness, really. You know, talking about white consciousness, but as a negative. So that's how this one is. And so this teacher, you know, university instructor, wrote this. It said, a student in my American literature class wrote the following response to a civil rights document I read in class. What this student wrote was, I can sympathize with the black population of the 1960s because now that they are being compensated, others such as myself are experiencing inequality. My own college education was threatened because the college has to admit a percentage of minorities. Now, this instructor says, I was quite intrigued by my student's comment. It seemed to sum up what a lot of white students are thinking these days. And more importantly, this attitude expresses something new in American culture. My student's implicit attack on affirmative action is nothing new. Criticism of the policy has been around since it began 30 years ago. Not 30 years ago. However, what is new in my student's statement is its revelation of a white racial consciousness. Until recently, the only white Americans who possessed much consciousness of their race and whiteness were Klan members and neo-Nazis. These far-right extremists were concentrated in places so far south that they were foreign to citizens in the northeastern states. Aside from these few hardcore white supremacists, see, now he's calling them white supremacists. Well, of course, Klan and neo-Nazi, yeah. Most white Americans were oblivious of their own race. Race, according to most whites, was something that other people had. Whites might talk about a black student, a Latino professor, or an Asian coworker, but a white person was simply a student, a professor, or a coworker. Well, that's true, and I think that might be true of every race. If you're black and you're living among blacks and you're talking to blacks, you don't call people a black student or I had a black professor or you just call them what they are, you know. If you have a coworker, I think all races do this, particularly when they're in their own homeland and they're the majority. It's not just white people. We just do this in our own homelands. If I were living, and I have lived in a country of that wasn't white, then I would distinguish if I'm talking about people that they were, you know, one of my kind, that they were, I would usually distinguish them by their nationality, not their race. But that was back before I was so racial. So they say, any qualification that we were likely to add to our own self-description was ethnic, not racial, true. We were Italian, American, Polish, or Jewish, but white, it seldom came up. Not until recently. Suddenly, white Americans are conscious of their whiteness. And for most whites, like my student, that whiteness is tied to a sense of victimization. He repeats what this student wrote. The student also wrote, my college admission is threatened because I am white. My chance of getting a job is threatened because I am white. I may never get a promotion because I am white. That's what this white student wrote in this class, assignment. And so the instructor continues, to hear many whites talk, you would think that blacks and other people of color were vastly overrepresented among students in the best colleges, among candidates for the best jobs, and among the workers getting promotions. This simply is not true. No matter where you look, the pattern is the same. Whites are vastly overrepresented in terms of their percentage of the population, and the number of blacks and Latinos with college degrees and high-paying jobs is still dismally low. Okay, dismally low. The new white consciousness is misguided, which makes it dangerous. But the solution is not a return to the good old days when most whites had no racial consciousness at all. Rather, I would argue that what we need is a genuinely new white consciousness, one that recognizes the reality of what it means to be white in America. Well, I stopped there because what he wrote after that was how we should make room for all the, to be white in America is to be just one of the groups of people in America and not dominate America and all of that kind of thing. You know, that's what his solution was. And that's what you find when you look for white consciousness. But this is very instructive, I think, as to that this student was awake to what's going on, and this is what we have to encourage more and more of. And however we do it, we have to encourage this racial consciousness as being white. And I said this a long time ago on this program, a few times here and there, and I'm still saying it. So we have two things. We have the education, and Tan Stoffel said last week on the ADL program, when I said, I was saying, well, you know, how would we form this thing? And he said, and he repeated to me later afterwards, that he thinks it's too late in the United States for that. And he doesn't think that's not the way that he would go, that he just wants to educate. He thinks we need to educate. Well, I think I can't help but be more of an activist. And even though I myself am not going to go out and be an activist anymore, although I used to some degree, but that's when it was not in anything that was worthwhile, that I think is worthwhile now. But so I was wasting my time. But I tend to be want to do something. You know, I want to do something. So I'm partway with Alex Linder in his idea that that it also takes real life organizing and real life work. And I have to agree with that. Now, I would say Hadding Scott is maybe somewhat closer to Tanstoffel in that he wants to educate people. And he wants to talk, and he thinks that we need to reason with people. But we also need to always tell the truth. And if we always tell people the truth, they'll eventually come around. But he's not, I'm not sure. We'll talk about that next week. But I think a lot of people see this in different ways. So, well, speaking of Greg Johnson, he also just wants to educate people. He just wants to write and publish and leave it at that. He doesn't want to get into any real life activism. Now, Alex Linder looks down on this kind of thing. And, but he's not able to really organize anything either. It's very, very difficult. But at least, it's how you look at it. I think that we should be always looking at that because it is about not just changing people's mind, a few people, because the power is in the hands of the enemy. And so you have to eventually somewhere take some power. And that's why I still like the idea, because it's the best I can come up with, of the ADL for White People. I see that as an organization that would be very, very focused. It's not a whole big organization for white people. It's just an organization to defend white people who are being defamed. And maybe I will throw in here at the last minute that, you know, we've been told about this the fellow that is the shooter supposedly at the Sikh temple. But there is a video going around, and I had seen that, and it didn't even dawn on me when I watched it the first time several days ago, that the son of the fellow who runs that temple, who was killed, was describing what happened right in the beginning, right afterwards, and said that four white men dressed in black with guns walked into the temple. Now, how can that fit with this one shooter? It doesn't fit. So already we have possibly something that shows that this is, unless I'm missing something, I don't know what else has been discovered about this, but this is something to pay attention to. Ladies and gentlemen, this show is over, and I want to thank you for being here and listening, those who are here live. I want to thank all those who will listen later. I want to say that it's been kind of a hard row to hoe to do this show. I'm glad it's over, actually. And I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you come back next week to another Heretics Hour program. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.